I was saying that to Ruth. I used to watch sort of videos of the time in awe, because Ruth would have sort of one eye on her mallets and one eye on Frank and another eye on her timps, because she'd be going over there in a minute, and also another eye watching what Georges are going to do. And
Yes.
Right there.
Oh, it was so much fun having George. Oh, God. You know, George used to talk about... I'm sure there were times when Frank would approach George, who was the heartbeat. You know, the heartbeat was not necessarily the drum, even though in a symphony orchestra, the heartbeat is always the timpanist, and he's always one of the highest paid members of the orchestra. I always felt that the heartbeat in that band was George, and that was Frank's right arm. I just always felt that way. That person who would have been the concertmaster to a conductor, the first violinist, he's the guy. But in the band that I was in, or the few bands, it was George. And to be opposite him, oh, my God. And just every now and then the eye would go up, because he was working his butt off playing a million things all the time. And but we often had to double each other with, as George would call it, the little notes.
Yes.
He didn't call it dots the way you do. George called it little notes. And I know there were times when Frank was either pissed off at me or... was deciding whether to have me in the band for the next, you know, tour or whatever. And George would tell me that Frank would say, well, what do you think? You know, think you want to play in a band with Ruth again? Especially if there'd be a hiatus where I quit once and missed a tour. Right. That was a tour that Beefheart did, and Brucey was on that one. And George's comment to Frank, apparently, was... oh, yeah, you know, I mean, what are you, crazy? I'm going to be alone here playing the little notes. I need her. And I've thought about that the few times that I allow myself to really live in that world again, because it's not productive for my life now, you know, or I'll drive my car off the freeway or something if I get too mesmerized by that. But I thought of that. And when I listen, when I go back and listen to some of that stuff, and I think... he needed help playing the little notes. Is he fucking out of his mind? George Duke didn't need help doing anything. He played those notes better than anybody. Anyway, so George, I mean, George.
Thank you.
Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to episode 14 of the ZappaCast for October of 2013. This is a very special episode of the ZappaCast in which we pay tribute to the late, great Mr. George Duke, who passed away on August 5th of this year. George was much beloved by Zappa fans everywhere, and of course, not only Zappa fans, but fans of music in general. George did a lot of work, as most of you will know, in the jazz field. And in this program, we are going to be hearing a whole bunch of stuff from the length and breadth of George's career. The track that you heard at the top was a piece called Fouche, which was written by Mr. George Duke. And that is from the 1969 album, The Jean-Luc Ponty Experience with the George Duke Trio, marking the first major collaboration between Ponty and George, who, of course, would later go on to work together in the 1973 incarnation of the Mothers of Invention. The crux of the biscuit for this program is an interview with George that was conducted in January of 2012 by our very own favorite professor, Mr. Mick Eakers, who got the chance of a lifetime to talk with George at length in an interview recorded during the research phase of his forthcoming book, Zappa's Gear. More about the book a little bit later on. At the very start of this show, we included a short extract from another one of George's interviews with the lovely Ruth Underwood, talking about George and his impact on her. So without any further ado, from January 2012, here is George Duke talking with Mick Eakers, right here on the ZappaCast.
You there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, yeah, if I don't get this espresso in here, I'm not going to be any good for you. That's my drug of choice.
Absolutely, I'm right with you on that one.
But, I know it's later there for you, but with me, I'm just getting it going.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, you can go ahead. I'm going to switch back to the other phone in a minute, but we can start.
Okay, cool. All right, first thing I was going to talk to you about, I'm going to sort of jump out of sequence. I'll just be listening to the Feel album. That's really quite interesting to me because it's about one of the only albums that I think Frank guested on that he wasn't like producing or managing.
Yeah, I'll tell you how that came about, man.
Right.
You know, Frank actually did a demo for me that he produced, and I did three tracks.
Right.
One was Uncle Remus. One was a tune called Psychosomatic Dung. And another was, I don't remember. So it was another tune. And we were going to originally take it and maybe put it out on his label, Bizarre, or one of the other labels that he had that was running, I think, through Warner Brothers at the time. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah.
It might have been Mercury. I'm not sure. So anyway, we, you know, we went in the studio, and all the time I was working with Frank, obviously, I guess, as you know, I continued to make my own records for MPS at that time whenever we were off, and I had some time. And so we were in the studio, and, you know, I was working with Frank, and I was working on my record whenever we weren't working. So I just asked him if he'd come play something. You know, there was a tune called Psychosomatic Dung, which I believe was on the first, on the Faces and Reflection record, which is my first MPS record on the new contract in the 70s, which Frank didn't play on, but he actually produced the original track.
All right.
You know, I took those tapes and actually did some, you know, rearrangement, put my band on and all that. And so there was this other tune that I thought would be great for Frank to play, but we never recorded it when Frank was producing the stuff for me. And so he just came in and played, but I couldn't use his name. It was really as simple as that.
Yeah.
And so I said, Frank, I got to have a name. I know I can't use your name. And so he says, okay, Abdul X.
Right.
And then he spelled it for me. And I said, really? Okay, fine. You know, a lot of people asked me who that was over the years.
You hear what I mean about Frank sounding like Ernie Isley as well. I think he was really doing it just for you, because I never heard him play with that tone anywhere else.
Well, you know, he used to have some fuzz boxes and stuff. I didn't specifically ask him to play like Ernie Isley, who I love, by the way.
Yeah.
I tried to get him to play on my last album, and I couldn't get him.
Okay.
But, you know, Frank, he was kind of interesting in terms of the guitars, because I totally believe, and I know I'm not answering your question now, but I'm just throwing this out. I think he was underrated as a guitarist. I just don't believe he ever received the accolades that he should have as a guitarist, because he was very interesting the way he thought about music and the way he soloed and the way he constructed his melodies.
Yes.
You know, they were like little packets of ideas, and then they're kind of put together. And, of course, he didn't want any music on stage. You had to remember all this stuff. But when he was soloing, he soloed exactly the same way. They were like packages of, like, rhythmic ideas, and then he moved to the next idea. You know, and a lot of times it would be, you know, he'd start off, for example, with just a couple of beats over, you know, but still, the beat is still going on. It's very mathematical, but it has an emotional content as well. Very interesting, and I've never seen anybody else ever in my career that thought about music and played the way he played.
Everyone who hears and that is
play the blues with it. And yeah, it was you know what? It was designs. It was like,
yeah,
it was like rectangles and squares and octagons, and it was different shapes and very, very. I learned so much, man, by just being in his presence. I mean, the guy was a genius.
When you joined the Mothers, was that after the John Luke Ponty album?
The first recording I did with Frank was Jungle's Revenge.
Right, okay.
That was the first thing, and then Dick Bach, who was the president of World Pacific Jazz Records, which was part of the United family, had an idea for Jean-Luc Ponty, who I was working with at that time, to do a record with Frank. And it was really as simple as that. We played some jazz, used to play a lot of jazz clubs around the L.A. area, along with playing certain places in Europe. And we were playing at this place called The Experience, which was right on Sunset Boulevard. And there were Frank and a lot of other artists came down to see this incredible violinist playing electric violin and playing all this kind of modern violin stuff, and they'd never heard anything like that. And I just happened to be there because Jean-Luc gave me a shot, you know, to actually to play with him. You know, I was just out of my teens, and essentially, the idea came up for him to do a record with Frank, and Jean-Luc didn't really want to do it. You know, he kind of said, "Well, I'll do it if George plays keyboards." And it's pretty much the same reason we played that rock club, The Experience, because he says, "Well, I'll do it as long as I can bring my keyboard player, who happened to be me."
Right.
And Frank heard me live, booked me for this date we did in with the L.A. Phil, I think it was, at UCLA, did a show there. And the next thing I know, he asked me to join the band. It was pretty much as simple as that. But it was really, I think, more than anything else, based on the King Kong album. I truly believe that.
Yeah. We'll be right back. when you started with Frank, did you just bring your own rig along, or did he give you? I mean, I know he tried to give you a synthesizer at some point. What about other keyboards? Was that all your own?
Yeah, no. The first time he provided everything.
Yeah,
I was still living in the Bay Area at the time, and of course all his work was going on in L.A. So I had to fly down and stay in a hotel. I can remember the first time I auditioned. You must have had some kind of keyboard there, you know. I think he might have had a piano and a couple other things. Maybe a Fender Rhodes. I don't remember at this point.
Yeah.
But they were his keyboards, not mine. Eventually, when I moved to L.A. after I joined the band, of course, I began using my own keyboards.
Right.
You know, more and more. But no, initially, it was his Rhodes. It basically his. Once I started playing synth, you know, he actually bought a NARP 2600 and just stuck it on my keyboard.
Right.
You know, and I took it home and tried to learn it. I talked to Ian Underwood about it, and Ian kind of gave me a few things, but it was just a little too heady for me. You know, and I wasn't really interested. I needed something simpler, and so Frank got me a Mini Moog.
Yeah.
Stuck it on there, and I said, well, that's kind of interesting. But, you know, from there I heard a guy named Jan Hammer who was playing with the Mavish New Orchestra, and I said, well, he's playing a Mini Moog, so it must be something else out there. And I started looking around, and I met this guy named Tom Oberheim, and I decided to play the Arp Odyssey because it was a little different than a Mini Moog. And eventually I went on to play both, but I decided to make the Odyssey my instrument. And I played that mostly with Frank.
And you were playing a Hammond organ with the band, I think?
No, I played a Farfisa.
It's a Farfisa. And that was yours, or?
Yeah. No, that was Frank's. The first thing that I played in the 70s, when I went over with Frank, especially Europe, and when everybody thought I was Billy Preston, because there weren't very many black guys playing in quote-unquote white rock groups.
Yeah.
Not to say that Frank was a rock group, because it's not in the classic sense, but still, there weren't a lot of guys. There was Billy Preston, who would play with the Beatles, and so they just figured I must be Billy.
Really?
So they say, Billy, Billy. I'm looking around like, who the hell are they talking about? You know, no, George. But that was back then, and I was playing Farfisa and trombone. That's what I was playing in the band, and Ian Underwood was playing more of the keyboard parts than me. But I had a Fender Rhodes there, so Fender Rhodes, Arp Odyssey, a Farfisa, and trombone. That was it.
Right.
Back in the 70s.
Do you still play trombone much?
Oh, no. That was dead. When I went back with Frank back in 73 when Jean-Luc joined the band, because I left Frank for a couple of years, and when I was Cannonball Adderley, I had to do the jazz thing for a couple of years. But when I rejoined Frank in 73 when Jean-Luc came in, I told Frank, I said, I'll join on one condition, that I will not have to play that damn trombone.
Right.
And so Frank said, okay. And that was it.
Hi and howdy doody, I'm a union man, you can call me Rudy. Any of you boys not paid up on your cards? You know I'm pleased to meet ya, been trying all day to reach ya. The union's here to help every one of you rock and roll stars. Rock and roll stars. Right out.
Okay. Well, I mean, because when you came back, the music got a lot more complicated, a lot more interesting, didn't it, really?
Oh, quite. And they didn't need me to play trombone. He had Bruce Fowler.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Who played rings around me. So it, he still had that sound.
Yeah.
You know, it was much more jazzy, though he wouldn't admit it. You know, I said, man, you're playing jazz. You can call it what you want. But this is some of the hardest music I ever played in my life. Yeah, it was very different than anything. But and that's one of the reasons I decided to go back with Frank, because the music that he was suggesting that we play or wanted to play was really interesting, man. I mean, besides being quirky like it always was and all that, it had another thing going on that really required musicians that could play but also were a little nuts.
Do you got another story?
Another story?
For Frankenstein?
That I can talk about on camera? You want to talk about on camera?
In Holland, yes.
No, I remember nothing. Well, I'll give you one. Somewhere along the line, I don't know whether Frank talked to you about it, we instituted what's called eventually the Booger Bear War. Now, the way that developed is because, I don't know if I should do this. No, well, anyway, and it was what it meant. The booger bear meant it was a kind of a homely woman. Homely, not a good-looking girl, in other words. And so there used to be these groupies that hung out at the show. And so some of the guys were, involved with that kind of thing. And they made up this mask that kind of looked like a cross between a gorilla and a, those shrunken heads they have in Africa where they look like turnips that are drunk, So with hair and the whole bit, and they put one of these on the door. So whoever had the booger bear for the evening, they had that on their door, and it became a topic of conversation on the bus. Because everybody would come out of the room and look to see whether they had the booger bear wore, And that went on for a while. Everybody laughed. Frank laughed. Everybody was having fun with it until Frank got it. That was the end of the booger bear wore. Because Frank said, "Why did I get it? Who put that on my door?" Everybody was like mute. The whole band was giggling. Frank was serious. He was pissed. It's as simple as that. But we were young and foolish.
Old and foolish.
Now I'm a grandpa, so it's okay.
Hi, this is the Idiot Bastard. That was George talking backstage in Hilversum, Holland in 2009 with Paul Burkholst and Co. De Clue. I'm happy to say that I got to see George a couple of times after that, at London's Chess Cafe and at Zappanali last year. It was truly a sad moment coming back from Zappanali this year to find out that he'd passed away. The fact that there were some who thought it was a hoax is a measure of the fact that no one wanted to believe it was true. I know there are some sick fucks out there, but you couldn't joke about that. Anyway, I was also fortunate enough to see George perform way back in the 70s and 80s in the days when I was a jazz funketeer. Initially, I hadn't really paid too much attention to his post-Zappa career. Not until the weekly British music paper Sounds gave away a free album called Major Road Ahead. This included Reach For It as well as a bunch of other great tunes by related artists that sent the young me searching down a completely new musical avenue. I had a lot of fun checking out some of George's funk and jazz explorations, and it opened my eyes to the fact that really great musicians needn't be pigeonholed and could turn their hands to whatever music their hearts desired. As George said, it's possible to like everything from Stevie Wonder to Stravinsky, so George helped take my blinkers off. When I used to frequent Flick's nightclub in Dartford, Kent, back in the 80s, my pals were very surprised that the guy singing this next song used to play with my hero Zappa. It's hard to believe that George didn't think he had a great singing voice. Check this out and believe. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I'd be both.
Yeah, I think the Roxy Band is probably.
Oh yeah.
One of the most delightful bands I've ever seen, really. But.
Yeah, I agree. That was my favorite band. The Roxy Band, Roxy Nelsworth Band. All of that period was an amazingly creative period for Frank. Yeah, I don't even know what else to say. It's definitely yeah. My favorite band.
What always struck me, seeing sort of videos and things as well, it seems to be the happiest band that Frank had for a long time. Everyone seemed to be not only working their nuts off, but really happy and enjoying it.
We were pretty cool. We worked all the time, and it was a happy band. I mean, when Napoleon Murphy Brock joined the band, which Chester and all that kind of, Chester Thompson and all that, it was an interesting thing. I mean, it's just because Nappy was almost like instantaneously knew what Frank wanted. You know, it took me a long time to figure this out, but Nappy walked in and was like, he's got it. He understood exactly what to do to make Frank smile.
Right.
And Frank just loved it, you know. And Chester, on the other hand, I said, when he auditioned, I said, he'll never get this gig because he's too grumpy. He never smiles. And he just, you know, but Frank likes diversity. He likes whatever's gonna. He thinks is weird. That's what he wants to do. I guess it was weird putting me in the band because I was a little straight laced, black suit, thin black tie, white shirt wearing jazz player. And why would I be in the band? It was just he just loved that kind of dichotomy. It's just stuff that doesn't quite work together, and you just put them together and see what comes out. It's an interesting way to make music and live life.
Come from somewhere out there, just to land in the Andes. Was it round and did it have a motor, or was it something different?
Look out! Wait a minute! Oh, sit. Who's in the back? What do you mean? Got to put a red light out there.
Never doing anything. I said, I'm going home a couple of days. I said,
Then a vehicle. Fly along the mountains and find a place to park itself. Park itself.
Park it. Park it.
Or did someone build a place to leave a space?
A space?
For such a thing to land.
Thank you.
of the hill, from the summer rat of the hill. From summer rather than the end, yes, return the bell, from the hill.
Something specific here. I'm looking at the Waka Chewaka album.
Yeah, sure.
And anyway, I'm just asking, you're credited on here as a ring modulated and echoplexed electric piano, which is obviously high tech for those. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, well, I remember I used to play this little, it was an Oberheim ring modulator that I used to love. It was black with a little gold or yellow lightning strike across it. And I used to love to play it with the Fender Rhodes. Yeah, of course I did that. And the Echoplex was a big thing back then, you know, on the Rhodes and whatever else you use it on. But those, I was with Cannonball Adderley during that time that we did those records. And that partially, while I was still with Cannon, when I was available to do it, back in L.A., Frank would call and I'd go work on him in the studio. So I kept my connection with Frank all during the time I was with Cannonball Adderley in 71 to 72.
Yeah.
But 74... No, 74. No, I was still back. I was back with the band, but you know, it was like he was beginning to do other kinds of music, and I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like I said, Jean-Luc was in the band for a while until I think it got a little too much for Jean-Luc. He loved the music, but I don't think he particularly cared for the antics. And he was a serious musician.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yes. But and
it
Ruth
didn't work.
Ruth on marimbas and stuff as well, of course.
Oh, well, Ruth was incredible. I did a little thing for on the death of Frank, on the anniversary of his death, you know, in December last year with Dweezil and, you know, in the band.
Oh, yeah.
Zappa Plays Zappa. Here in L.A., I did two nights and playing with them, and we played all Big Swifty and all that old stuff, you know, Anchor Roads and all that. And it was very interesting. I actually had to practice because I forgot half of that stuff. It was really, really kind of interesting. And they were telling me that they were trying to get Ruth back in to come do some dates with them, and it looked like she was going to do it.
We'll be right back.
okay, moving on, some of the other stuff you did. One Size Fits All and Roxy and Elsewhere with the with that band. Can you remember anything about the recording sessions at all?
Yeah, well, One Size Fits All and Apostrophe,
yeah,
those albums were basically me and Frank in the studio for hours. I mean, it was just, and the engineer, Kerry McNabb.
Yeah.
We would be there at Paramount Recording Studio or wherever, you know, just recording like from 1 or 2 in the afternoon till 5 or 6 in the morning. I mean, generally every night I got back when the sun was up, got back home, and then go to sleep for 6, 7, 8 hours, go back in the studio and do it again. And it was just basically running through synth patches, trying to find sounds that Frank would like. And by that time, I kind of understood what Frank was looking for. So a lot of that stuff I kind of came up with. If Frank didn't like it, he'd tell me.
Yeah.
But I really knew Frank by that time. You know, I wasn't as quick as Nappy, but I had figured it out. And those are great records. He got me singing, and you know, because I really didn't want to sing, but by those records, you know, because of what happened live, he needed someone to sing certain parts, and I was the only one that was stationary on stage.
Yeah.
And so he says, "Man, I need you to sing this part." And so that's how I started singing, and it worked into me doing leads, you know, like for Anchor Rose and a few other tunes.
Yeah.
Which I really did not want to do, but I was in the band. Frank says, "This is for you." I was like, "Oh, Jesus. Okay. Well, how's it go?" You know. And of course, by the time we got to Roxy and Elsewhere, that was a band. I mean, we had been on the road, we had toured, it was a real band, and probably the closest thing to what a Frank Zappa show was like that I think I've ever heard, short of the stuff we did in Helsinki and all of that, which was actually live,
yeah,
as well. But that was the first one, Roxy and Elsewhere, that I can remember that was live, that was really what I thought represented that band.
Yeah, I think it's one of my favorites. It's got everything. It's got the comedy, the silliness of the audience, and then the most ludicrously complicated music.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. I'm telling you, and we never knew what was going to happen, ever. I mean, and that's hopefully Zappa plays Zappa. Those guys will begin to understand that that's what made this stuff really work, is the fact that, you know, it not only played well, and even the music was complex a bit, and you had to have that type of expertise. But there was also this other side, which was just total trash. Just, you know, throw the wrench in it.
Should have been written, but actually it was written about 1970.
This is a song, we like to dedicate this song to Marty, our road manager, who has a fondness for the canine species. And the orifice attendant there too. Don't tell me no. Don't you tear my dream. Don't you break my heart. Darling, we could share a love so that you hear in the background right now is the sound caused by George Duke agitating two metal insignias. These are badges that he removed from a couple of boogers that Marty tried to palm off on him in the last time that it was in. Actually, they're booger pasties, and he's hitting the booger pasty with a little stick to get a very interesting musical effect. You know, he does this every night, and sometimes he becomes so overwrought, so excited by the fact that he's actually touching a piece of metal that might have at one time come in contact with the actual flesh of a booger bear. And so sometimes he misses it and he hits his thumb and he hurts himself. Yes, it hurts very much. But he likes pain. We can tell that he likes pain because he's in this group.
But it's very close to other things.
Yes, but later that night, after George was finished fondling the booger pasty, a thought came to his mind. How can I possibly get any nook tonight in Passaic if I don't put this thing down and play the piano and get funky for these people? And so George, as you say in your language, took it away.
But before we get funky, the continuing stories of the... No, this ain't Moon Trek this time. We go to Moon Trek next show. This is the continuing stories of the Boogers of Marty Pirellis. Do you all know who he is? There he is. He got a white shirt on there and a...
Your 250 closest relatives, the mothers of invention.
Yes. Anyway, he was in my room. I invited some people over. Young ladies. They look interesting. Their names shall go unmentioned.
The reason they looked interesting is because they apparently were intelligent enough to dress themselves.
Anyway, what was happening was nothing. Well, nothing happened. So I said, let's get this party on the road. I said, let me call the road manager. I said, what's your name? Marty Pirellis, come down here and meet Miss Cool. Miss Jew. And Miss Stool. So Marty got in there, and he was there about 5 minutes, and all of a sudden, I began to hear other things. I said, what you doing over there? I said, I never heard nobody do that kind of thing before. I said, come out of that corner. What's wrong with you? And so he commenced to, you were all kind of chested. Man, what you doing over there?
Really whipping it, just whipping it into a frenzy.
All of a sudden, he was gone. I looked around, and Marty had took the book out of his room. I said, where are you going? He went down to his room, which is room 33. And so...
That's the doo-doo room.
2 hours later, I made a phone call. I said, what you doing? He said, I ain't gonna tell you. He said, an hour later, I went to his room, I knocked on his door, I said, what you doing? He said... I said, say that again. I said, oh. It was late. We had an 8 o'clock wake up. You all know what that is. 8 o'clock wake up. 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 So Marty came out in the hall and looked at Napoleon and said, can I say this? He said, smell my beard. I said, you must be crazy.
I had to smell it.
Show how you was walking, Marty. And he said, smell my beard. I said, I ain't gonna smell nothing. Napoleon said, I'll check it out
and make sure.
Anyway, if you want to hear, you know what happened to us
like
tonight?
Marty's odor.
Come to the next show for the continuing stories
Marty's
of
odor.
Marty Trek. But for now, what are we going to do?
Odor.
White juice on him.
Yeah, the Booker Man.
White juice on his beard. White juice on his beard.
The Booger Man.
White juice on his beard.
In my room.
White juice on his beard.
Look at the booger.
White juice on his beard.
And he was gone.
White juice on his beard.
In 3 hours.
White juice on his beard.
Didn't sing no song.
White juice on his beard.
I said, what you doing?
None of your business.
Then what you doing?
None of your business.
Oh, I'm talking about the Booger Man. Right over there. The Booger Man.
Wonder why
I said, what you doing?
Wonder why
with those tricks.
Wonder
You know, Mark and Howard were just, that was instant energy.
Yeah.
And total craziness. I mean, you had to realize 1970, as I said, I was a straight-laced jazz player. To meet somebody like Mark and Howard,
yeah.
You know, from the Turtles, it's crazy. It was the ultimate rock and roll hang. I mean, with that, and then when we did 200 Motels, you know, with Ringo Starr and the drummer, what's his name, you know, from The Who?
Yeah, Keith Moon. Yeah. Keith Moon.
It was debauchery. I mean, it was just backstage. That should have been the movie. there was stuff going on backstage that was absolutely amazing. I mean, I went over with my wife, who I'm still married to right now.
Right.
When we went there backstage, she almost said, you know what, I don't know if I want to do this. Because she said, these guys you work with are pretty crazy. I said, look, I'm in it. I'm not of it.
Right.
You know, we eventually got married, and thanks to Frank, actually.
Really?
Allowing me to establish residence there. Because he and Gail had a home there, and you had to be there for 3 months. So I just put my name in and gave the address, Frank's address, and that was it. Matter of fact, Frank was supposed to be my best man. And Gail was the maid of honor at our celebration, but wound up being Herb Cohen, which was cool anyway. But it was just crazy backstage, man, between Keith Moon and Howard Kalin. You know, Lord Jesus, I can't even... Pretty crazy. The offstage stuff was probably funnier than anything we did on stage. It really. And the on stage things that happened on stage were really an extension of what happened off stage.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the songs were born out of things that happened off stage. Frank was notorious for that because he was always running around with a tape recorder.
Yeah.
With just two microphones, gaffer's tape to this recorder, and he was taping stuff, and he would take something that Jeff Simmons would say, or Howard Kalin would say, or Mark Volman, or me, you know, that's how that whole downbeat line came out, because I used to walk around carrying this doggone downbeat, you know, in my satchel I used to wear on my shoulder.
Right.
And Frank got this idea and put it in the movie. You know, and it, you know, like I want to carry around downbeat so I can look like I'm hip and know what I'm doing or whatever I said. You know, he gave me the line. You know, so which was funny, and I did it. But all of that stuff was basically true.
Yeah.
I mean, it was glorified, but it was still, you know, magnified, but still, it was, the kernel of it was in truth. All of it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, making his first appearance on the Berlin Jazz Festival, we're very proud to present one of the great alto saxophone players in jazz music, Cannonball Adderley and the Quintet. And first of all, The music is going to start with the rhythm section of the Cannibal Adderley Group, and I'd like to introduce them to you one by one. First of all, on the drums, Roy McCurdy. On the bass, Walter Booker. And at the piano, and the electric piano, is George Duke.
Marshalls there.
Yeah.
But he got a lot of sound out of what he had, considering it didn't seem to be that much to me. But I know that he would put, later on, he would put Captain Beefheart in front of his amp because he liked to see how he'd react.
Right.
You know, because the level of the volume, you know, when it got to a certain point, would make, you know, Frank would hit this note and it'd make Dodd Van Fleet do something funny, which made Frank laugh. It was simple as that. And it was specifically placed, Don, right in front of the amp, you know, further up, downstage, but still it was in front of the amp and with all the papers around Don because he never could remember any of the lyrics.
Yeah.
So all these papers were on the floor, and Frank would hit this note, and the air from the amp would blow the paper all over the, you know, they weren't taped out. So he would go around just trying to pick up the papers, you know, the lyrics, you know, and just like every time a Frank would hit a note, Ron was like, God, and then he'd start, it was a hilarious band.
Yeah. I mean, because people talk about that band with Don as if it was a, you know, there was a bit of bad vibes and sort of, Don was hard work from what I hear, but
Yeah, well, Don, you mean, yeah, well, Don was tough, you know, and he would never go to sleep, you know, when we went on the road, you know, and by that point, Terry Bozzio had joined the band, and that was kind of, that was in 76, and that was 75,
yeah.
And that was, the Bongo Fury was the last record I did with Frank, and then I left and went on and, to do other things, but, yeah, there were a lot of guys, not only from that period, Flo and Eddie included, you know, and who kind of got a bad taste in their mouth. Basically, I think because Frank, I tell you, man, for me, I don't care what any of these other guys say, and I respect them all,
yeah.
But for me, I gain more from just being a part of that than to argue about whether I got paid a certain residual or not. Because, but then on the other hand, I'm in a little different position than some of these other guys. I'm still making a living playing. I'm doing well. And so I don't really care about that. I really don't. And so the long hours that I spent working with Frank, no, I didn't get paid for it, but I definitely got paid for it in another way.
Yeah.
I didn't get paid financially, but I reap benefits far beyond receiving a few dollars for residual from a record. So that's the way I look at it. So I've got no problem. I have no problem with Frank, but some of the other guys do. And they feel they should have been paid for their work for the long hours they put in, and they got a point, you know. But I don't feel the same way.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think that sort of the people in those bands, you're a bit like sort of, you know, working in the space race. You're doing something that nobody ever did, and although you only got paid scale while you were going up to the moon,
right.
You know,
right.
You can make what you want of it afterwards, but.
Yeah, I think we're making musical history. To tell you,
absolutely.
But you know, the other part of it is, I think it's a personality thing, because once you were not part of Frank's world, you were not there. I mean, it was like you didn't exist almost. And a lot of guys, I think, took exception to that. For me, I kind of understood it, you know, because it was almost like Frank knew that he had limited time. And he had a lot he wanted to get done, a lot he wanted to say before he checked out. And it was almost like, in hindsight, looking back at it, it was almost like somewhere deep inside him, he knew that he had limited time and he didn't have time for frivolity, you know, in terms of music.
Yeah.
This was a serious dedication. This was serious. If you weren't involved in making his next creation, then he didn't have time for you. It was really simple as that. And I don't know if it was personal. I think he just knew he didn't have time.
I'm back on the bus. I don't want to hear no fuss. Because I got all the love. What the? Bus. What y'all going to fuss at me for? I'm talking about them sweet things. I'm talking about them D things. I'm talking about them treat things. Dookie treat things.
Hello. I want a snack.
And the treats. I'm bringing them.
Duck and cheese.
Sweet ones.
D1.
Cheese. Big ones.
Old fashioned, baby.
Big ones.
Duck and cheese.
I'm tripping. Sweet ones. I got them.
Your weakness,
Siri.
like a mocktail to me. Bountiful and plentiful treats.
Oh, no, he didn't.
There's enough to go around. Okay. Here it.
Oh, the wall.
Let's rip up every wall. I love
the basic gear. I mean, it's by the time I think I left the band, I had all the basic stuff. Same thing I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
But I had a Mini Moog and an Arp Odyssey, and then all the effect things that went with it. You know, I had a Yamaha effect pedal, and of course I had a board. I used to have what do they call that thing? It was a Yamaha some RD-1000 or something. I don't know, like a 16-channel mixer. That right. I needed to mix all of this stuff and then the speaker. So it was a formidable rig. I mean, considering what I carry now, you know, which is nothing but a computer.
Yeah,
I mean, that was that was pretty amazing what we used to carry around. But no, Frank didn't really give me any things to play. As a matter of fact, if one of those instruments that I wear around my neck now had been invented and was working, there's no doubt that I would have used it in that band.
Right. Okay.
You know, because he used to constantly say, man, you need to find a way to get out from behind these keyboards and get to the front of the stage. You know, and eventually one day I was reading Downbeat magazine.
Right.
Believe it or not. And I saw this thing, and I said, wow, that looks like a guitar, but it's got a keyboard on it. And this guy's name was Wayne Yentis. And I found out he lived in L.A. I called him up. I said, man, is this real? And he says, yeah, you want to see it? I said, yeah, where do you live? And I went over to his house and looked at it. I said, look, this is exactly what I'm looking for. And then the story went on from there. But I had already left Frank by that point.
Thank you.
didn't really have a lot of communication with him towards the end.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I mean, I was busy doing other things. I got up to the house a couple of times. You know, we spoke a few times. He tried to get me to come up and do a few things, and like I said, I only got up there a couple of times, and but I had no idea that he was sick.
No, but he didn't tell anyone while he was on the road.
Yeah, I mean, if I had known that, I would have made the time to go.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah. But he was busy getting his last records done, like you said.
Yeah, true. Well, true. Right. Yeah, and now I know that. He says, man, because why don't you come up, back at, talking about playing on something. I said, well, he wants me to come up and jam, and I was kind of like, I'll see you next year. Next month or something. Okay. And next month was too late.
We'll be right back. And that is all she wrote for this episode of the ZappaCast. But before we go, I would like to give you a little rundown on the music that you heard during this episode. We heard Love from the Feel album, 1975, featuring Frank Zappa on guitar. We heard Idiot Bastard Son from the 1969 album King Kong. Jean-Luc Ponty plays the music of Frank Zappa, featuring George Duke on keyboards. We heard Rudy Wants to Buy Yous a Drink from the Chunga's Revenge album, 1970. We heard Eat That Question from the 1972 Grand Wazoo album. We heard Brazilian Love Affair from the 1980 George Duke album of the same name. Inca Roads from the early show on October 1st, 1974 at Festhall Mustermess in Basel, Switzerland. I think I got the pronunciation right this time. We heard Old Slippers from the 1975 Feel album, once again featuring Frank on guitar. From the early show in Passaic, New Jersey on November 8th, 1974, we heard a sequence featuring Ruthie Ruthie, a George Duke improvisation including The Booger Man and Smell My Beard. From Billy Cobham's Crosswinds album, we heard Heather featuring George Duke. We heard Sweet Baby from the 1981 album The Clark Duke Project featuring Stanley Clark and George Duke. We heard Black Messiah, George Duke playing with Cannonball Adderley from Berlin, 1972. From the album Dookie Treats, which was released in 2008, we heard the title track featuring Napoleon Murphy Brock on vocals. And from George's last album, Dreamweaver, which just came out this year, 2013, we heard Brown Sneakers, which is sort of a little tribute to his Zappa days. And we just heard a track called Jazzmatazz. And I think it's only appropriate to close out this show in which we pay tribute to everybody's keyboard hero, the late, great George Duke, with the final track from his final album, from the Dreamweaver album. Here's Happy Trails. And on behalf of all of us here at the ZappaCast, we would like to say happy trails and thank you very much, George Duke. Until we meet again, folks.
Happy trails.
I'll be back around. And I'll be getting down. And that piano for you, girl. But if you ever get lonely for me, girls, put that CD on. I'm gonna sing your favorite song. And if you ever get lonely for me, girls, just push one of those numbers on that CD. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or 10. And I promise you, it ain't gonna be long, baby. No, it ain't, baby. And it ain't gonna be long before I come back around. And let me just say, right here, right now, to someone special who's been in my life for a real, real, real long time. And if the words don't rhyme, they still gonna be on time. She's a special lady, and that's for true, that I had a bit of do. But I know one day I'll see her again, and that's for true. Love don't play by no rules. And I want you to know, I wish you happy trails, girl.
I wish you happy trails, girl.
Yes, I do.
Happy trails.
And that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The Zappacast was produced and edited by Andrew Greenaway, Mick Eagers, and Scott Parker. Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com. And if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers. And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com. And for more information about Scott Fischer, you can go to fischersflicker.com. That's F-I-S-C-H-E-R-S. FLICKER.com. Scott is a very wonderful musician and songwriter, and you can check out some of his music at that website. If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at SNET.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway
and Mick Eakers,
this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.